post-Battle of Iran and the grips of tyranny, economic shortage, the sort of thing that arises from planned economies. And I was so upset by it that I went to a friend of mine in the British Embassy, John Fernley, and told him about it. And I said, I must be going off my head. He said, I don't think you are at all. He said, I think you've had a real glimpse of what the future might hold. He and I were pessimistic about the future of the Pahlavi dynasty, and this, I must remind you, was in 1955.
But didn't anybody try to, I mean, obviously, we're not the only one to have this kind of feeling, but wasn't there anyone to articulate this feeling and pass it on?
No, it seems that certainly the foreign embassies didn't risk the Shah's obloquy and anger, his wrath, by mentioning the fact to him that certain aspects of his conduct might be arousing a great deal of hostility to his regime. It seems that he believed, and of course plenty of other people did too, presumably, that he was a dearly loved figure. This was a belief that increased and persisted almost to the eve of his departure from Iran in 1979. I thought it was quite wrong to suppose that he was a greatly loved figure. Other people, Western commentators, used rather to mock me. I remember once there was somebody saying to me, are you still looking for the revolution in Iran under your desk every morning when you get up? And I used to say yes, and the day I stopped looking for it is no doubt the day it will happen. That was in 1955, 1956, 1957. Of course, I was exposed to a certain amount of anti-regime pessimism in the talk of certain groups that I was in touch with. I was, for example, in fairly close touch with General Garani, who was in fact in charge of, I think, the Deuxième Bureau of the General Staff, the intelligence gathering part of the General Staff. I had contacts with him in connection with the road building operation, because I had to get permits from him to visit certain areas of Iran, and I became very friendly with him. He was a typical Turk, fairly simple, straightforward man, a man of great charm, a man I grew to respect. But strangely enough, I had no idea, although I met him in certain circles and there was a lot of critical comment of the government, but it never occurred to me that these people were actually thinking in terms of the possibility of a coup d'etat against the government, simply because the kind of conversation they were having was the sort of conversation which to me as an Englishman was a perfectly natural conversation, the kind of conversation we would have in England or in France about the government, where governments are criticized by ordinary intelligent people in their private gatherings, dinner parties and so on. We used to meet, these groups used to meet about once a week, and there would be a certain amount of tutting and expressions of regret over what were considered maladroit aspects of the Shah's policy, and over tortures of the torturing of the suspected political dissidents and so on.
But in those days,
it wasn't until after I left, of course, that Garani was arrested and cashiered from the army for having actually plotted against the Shah.
What was the plot?
I don't know. He had eventually been naive enough to go to the CIA and take CIA officials into his confidence, so I heard. And of course the CIA officials had then immediately revealed all to the Shah, which strikes me as being really rather childish and horrible and low and mean. They sneaked on General Garani.
But there was a period then, it seems to me, that after the quick purge of the top brass of the Tudeh party, after 1953, there was a sort of accalmie in the political dissidents, and that there wasn't too much arrest or torture or anything of the kind. At least it never came out. The people started talking about arrest and torture when guerrilla movements started in Iran, and where there was another clampdown after 63.
Yes, arrest and torture went on until 1955, and then, as I said, in the context of my meeting with Teymour Bakhtiar, things quietened down, and then, and I came out in 58, and then in the early, shortly after that, in 58-59, Teymour Bakhtiar himself, of course, became suspect as an enemy of the Shah's and had to leave the country. Then in 63, after the Shah's proclamations of 61, when the Shah began his white revolution, the famous Firman was issued, which the Prime Minister was instructed, Prime Minister in this case being Ali Amini, and the reforms being reforms introduced because John F. Kennedy really wanted them to be introduced, so it was part of a trimming operation to bring the ship of state in Iran onto the sort of tack that the new-look presidency of the United States, the Kennedy presidency, seemed to require. And the great Firman was issued, the Shah instructing Ali Amini, though the Firman seems largely to be written by Ali Amini, to institute the land reform, to institute various other things which became characteristic features of the White Revolution, in the absence of the Majlis, which had been suspended due to repeated corruption in its elections. And that was the beginning of a totally new phase, which was of course opposed by the Ulama, because they saw in it the erosion of their hold on wealth from endowments in land. They saw further erosion of their influence as partly as educators and as controllers of the minds and hearts of the people. They saw, they must have seen, as did left-wing opponents of the regime, they must have realized that this was the Shah's great moment to capture the hearts of the people, to out-Herod all the other reformists and opposition groups, by proving himself the arch-reformer, the revolution from the top, as he himself would put it. So that by 1963, after a series of protests from ulama circles, principally centered on Qom, which was the where all the great schools of theology were, you got riots, and which were very, very severely repressed at the point of the bayonet, so to speak, and which were thought by some, I do believe, including Hoveyda, who became a long-lasting prime minister, to signal the end of the ulama, the last kick, the last strike of the religious conservative traditionalist authorities in Iran against progress. The 1963 suppression of these elements was so great that it was considered that that was the end. In 1968, Hoveyda himself said to me words which, of course, have subsequently burnt in my memory. When I asked him, I said, "What about the religious classes' attitude towards progress, etc.?" This was in 1968. And he said, "The religious classes? Oh, that's all over." When I became Prime Minister, I asked predecessors what they did about the religious classes, and they said, "We hold a Shabnashini and let it be known that religious leaders and others of the religious classes are welcome. And they come along and we entertain them and establish a kind of rapport with them." And I said, Hoveyda continued, that I was in my office from 6 a.m. every day, and if any of the religious classes wanted to see me, they would know where to find me in my office. He said, "The religious classes, I think their power is finished." And I remember, as he said it, involuntarily glancing at the long French windows reaching to the floor, which was parallel to the chair on which he was sitting behind his desk as he was talking to me, and thinking to myself, "My goodness, I hope the glass in that window is bulletproof." Because I was aware that anybody in Iran, even in 1968, who thought that the religious classes were no longer an issue, were no longer capable of doing anything, was most likely, eventually, to receive a bullet in their flesh, fired by a gun held by a member of the religious classes.
Yeah. Why didn't you tell him, Peter?
Well, I didn't. It wasn't my, I was simply seeking information. I wasn't there to have a political argument about his country. And of course, you should know, being Iranian yourself, that it isn't very easy to tell an Iranian in office something that he doesn't want to hear and doesn't agree with. It was the meetings like that kind of meeting I had with my old friend Amir Abbas Saveda. It wasn't I who was telling him things, it was he who was very much telling me. The arrogance, the confidence that Iranians in high office at least showed was always a matter of surprise to me in view of the fragility of public positions throughout the history of Iran. Similarly with the Shah, because in 1975 Asadullah Aram, who was a very old friend of mine, told me that his problem was that he could no longer converse with the Shah. He could no longer attempt to question any of the Shah's decisions because he, Asadullah Aram's health was so bad that he could no longer stand, he said, the outbursts of ill temper, the rows that would ensue if he endeavoured to question any of the Shah's decisions or opinions. So it went right to the top. Asadullah Alam himself was never an arrogant man, I would like to add. He was always a quiet, listening type of person. And had my conversation been with Asadullah, I could probably, would probably have argued with him and said, oh, I don't agree, I think I should watch the religious classes. But then the situation wouldn't have arisen because Asadullah Alam would never have said that about the religious classes. It was Haveda who said it. Men so different in their outlook.
But you see, if I may say something here, it seems to me that under Reza Shah, the religious mullahs, at any rate, the top class, were much more suppressed. I mean, they were not allowed to wear their religious clothes at the university, all manner of things like that, and he somehow managed to deal with them. The Shah, late Shah, gave them a lot more free rein. I mean, Rozakhani was re-established, the mosques, everything. There was a lot more religious freedom, in fact, than under Reza Shah, you see. All it seems now, in hindsight, that all he had to do was to enlist the help of a few and then get rid of the radical elements, like Khomeini. And everything would have been all right. So I really don't, it's very difficult to understand that why the religious classes didn't do anything under Reza Shah, where they were really suppressed and put in their places, but that they opposed the late Shah so much when he gave them a lot of money, he put them all on retainers, so to speak, gave them so much money, gave them so much free rein, allow them to speak freely, all manner of things like that. It seems to me that the reason for it was really, maybe, or one of the reasons, that they really wanted power. And he gave them just enough free rein to think that they could have that power and that they wanted more. Had he suppressed them completely, maybe it wouldn't have happened. Maybe, I don't know, it seems to me that they took advantage of a situation which of general discontent to bring back.
Well, of course, Reza Shah was a very much more successful dictator than his son ever was. Reza Shah was an extremely strong man of whom everybody was very afraid. Nobody was actually afraid of the Shah, I think, of his son in the same way. Secondly, the son certainly gave the mullahs a certain amount of freedom and indeed provided them with subsidies. Well, it was a kind of freedom that made them think that if they pressed hard enough, they could get more.
That's it.
And thirdly, he did, of course, he was diverted from the idea, for example, of executing Khomeini. He showed, or was easily persuaded, to be unwilling to, showed unwillingness to execute members, leading members of the religious classes, though several did in fact die in jail, probably put to death, or dying of tortures. But in the case of Khomeini, the Shah, of course, spared his life, which is in the event can only be said to have been a grave mistake on his part. But of course, it must be remembered that the trouble really started when Armouza Gar, one of his last prime ministers, precipitously stopped the subsidies to the religious classes.
Yeah, but that was very quickly restored.
Right? It was restored, but it was it's still considered by some of Iranian observers of the revolution, the development, to have been a cause of to have triggered off the problem, the difficulties. However, be that as it may, I don't know why it was that the Shah did, of course, latterly stop paying any kind of attention to Islamic principles, and one of the key things was in 1971 the celebration of 2,500 years of Iranian monarchy. A lot of this flew very much in the face of Islamic tradition, as well as in the face of historical accuracy. It was a party to which I was invited, but which I did not go to because I couldn't believe that it would be correct for anybody who thought of himself as a historian of Iran to support so unhistorically unauthentic an event in terms of history. And also I did realize that it was an affront, it constituted a very grave affront to the Islamic principles of the nation.
Why?
Because it was played up a pre-Islamic Iran. Cyrus was the hero of the day, not Muhammad the Prophet, or Ali, the first Imam, after Muhammad. It played up entirely pre-Islamic ethics, pre-Islamic heroes, pre-Islamic national leaders. So it was a terrible affront to Islam, and was taken as such by the mullahs and by many Iranians at the time. And it was also an extremely expensive exercise at the time when many Iranians were very short of food and money. It was a very extravagant affair, and it was an affair put on by the Shah for the entertainment of hosts of foreign guests, so that it constituted that type of foreign invasion of Iranian privacy, which Iranians do resent. One of the notable examples of this resentment was the 1992 protest against the tobacco concession, partly because the tobacco concession was a terrible invasion of Iranian privacy. It put the processing and the marketing of a commodity which touched the mouths of numerous Iranians who smoked pipes in the hands of foreigners. Iranians don't like foreigners to be too prominent on the horizon, having too much obvious influence in the affairs of their country. And again, the Shah's policy led to the introduction of thousands of principally American advisors and so on of one sort and another, whom the Iranians didn't like the ubiquity of in their country. So that all these were factors building up to a disposition to criticize the Pahlavi regime. And things like the celebration of 7,500 years of monarchy were, I think, unwise, imprudent gestures.
Yes. Well, at the time, I remember going there to do a story for a newspaper here, and I put these objections,
yes,
quite frankly. And I was told that on the, what was on the plus side of the exercise, which is that number one, a great deal of good works got done as a result of these celebrations, you know, like the improvement of roads, and because of these celebrations we're going to have so many new schools and so many new hospitals and so many new things, which all got done, as it were, which wouldn't have otherwise. And the second thing was the PR aspect of it, which was to bring all these foreigners to the country, let them see for themselves what was happening, and therefore invest in the country and enhance trade with the country and so forth. So that was on the plus side of it. I don't know what you think, whether it worked or not.
No, I don't think it worked at all. As for the PR, it gave Iran rather a bad image abroad, because a good many people did criticize it and didn't like the extravagance and didn't know what it was all about anyway. And those of us who did know what it was about did in fact know who Cyrus was and what the history was, of course realized that it was phony history. So I don't think it achieved very much. As for schools and roads, well, you would expect a modern, stridently progressive, noisily progressive developing nation to be building schools and roads anyway without having to celebrate 2,500 years of monarchy with a lot of foreign guests and Maxims providing hundreds of chefs to provide fresh food in a country whose food is exquisite, whose cuisine is quite as marvellous, if not more, in some respects much more wonderful than the French. One wouldn't expect all these adjuncts to be necessary for the encouragement of building roads and schools. I mean, such an assumption seems to me to be absolute nonsense. No, I think it was ad maioram gloriam, as it were, to increase the grandeur, the pomp and the power and so on of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, and I think it grossly misfired and was certainly a factor in his downfall. Then in 1975, 4 years later, when he declared a one-party state. Well, I was asked by the BBC to say what I thought of it. I said, well, he wants to cut down factionalism, because one of the problems of trying to get the democratic institution to work in Iran was the factionalism, this individualism, which Iran is so notorious for, people breaking up into small factions, the proliferation of political parties and so on. And I assume that perhaps one of his motives was the establishment of a one-party state. But I realized at the time that it was an extremely dangerous move, because of course it smacked of one-party states, which we don't like, which are lead to dictatorships.
But the majority of the countries in the world at the moment are run by one-party systems. Well, huge countries like Russia, China,
yes,
all the satellites,
we
all
don't
the
consider
new Africa.
That the Russian system is one to emulate.
Of course not, but nobody seemed to have objected to that, whereas everybody sort of jumped on the show.
Well, a lot of people, I think, do object to one-party states, and certainly regret friends emulating it. Anyway, that was a dangerous move, but not perhaps all that dangerous, because not very many people took much notice of it. But of course it was a serious move, because in effect the declaration of the Rastakhiz Party, the Resurrection Party of Iran, did suggest that anybody who didn't join it was more or less an outlaw, was no longer a valid citizen of the country, could take his passport and go, that sort of thing. It was a bad move, and other moves like the establishment of the corps, the literacy corps, and other, I think, quite positive moves connected with land reform, of course, had their negative impact in that they introduced the government, the civil service, the administration, much more into the lives of the people. They started to send out arms, tentacles of government, into the remotest villages and areas of Iran. Again, a kind of invasion of this privacy that Iranians do cherish. It's one of the numerous paradoxes, I think, of Iran, that life is in hardly any country I can think of, life is not lived as publicly as it seems to be lived in Iran. And yet, whole areas of the family are totally private. The male members of the family, the leading members of the family, live, as it were, ostensibly with a great degree of publicity. But actually they live very privately behind the scenes. And so, in a country which is superficially seems fairly public, there is a tremendous sense of privacy and guarding of privacy. The introduction by the Shah of foreigners, foreign experts, foreign investigators into things, foreign improvers of the way people went to the lavatory, the way people might wipe their bottoms and so, all these things were an appalling affront to a nation that is as intensely private as the Iranian nation, I believe, to be. So these were the sort of things that made me pessimistic for the survival of the Pahlavi dynasty. However, after 1963, I was not particularly distressed. I was distressed at the methods used, which were cruel and horrible, but I was not particularly distressed at the cowing of the clerical classes, because I've never been a great sympathiser with the
clerical classes. But you see, the point is that they have the clerics since the Safavids, in fact since the advent of Shiism, have been perhaps the biggest element of stagnation and backwardness.
To corruption and greed.
And corruption.
Yes. And so from 1963 I slightly changed my stance and thought, with the increased gross national product, the increased economic activity, the almost frenetic economic activity that began after 1963, I began to assume, I was rather lulled into the position of assuming that somehow the dynasty would survive because of the enormous activity, and my former pessimism had perhaps been misplaced. I went on thinking like that. In 1968 I wrote an article for Chatham House's The World Today, a mood of increasing confidence, I think I called it, about how much more confidence I'd discovered in Iran on a recent trip there. That was 68. Then I went in 1977. And I'd been in the interim and begun to see signs of that again justified pessimism, made pessimism necessary. I began to hear rumors. I began to think, well, possibly the trouble is that I'm always mixing with people who are critical of the regime. Perhaps I'm being fed with too much pessimism. But be me. Pessimism is, after all, a characteristic of Iranians who are essentially highly idealistic, and to whom any sublunary situation, any mundane situation, is in fact a subject of pessimism. Iranians just don't believe in sublunary promises. Iranians think that only in heaven is perfection. No perfection is to be expected here on earth. This is absolutely central to Iranian religious belief, always has been. A lot of my Iranian friends were very Iranian people indeed, who spread a lot of gloom in their conversations with me. But they did cite instances which were very disturbing. The Shah's attempt to stop inflation by simply beating people into lowering their prices and popping merchants by the dozen into prison and so on on the charge of overcharging. Well, this was of course an absurdity, entailing a great deal of cruelty and unhappiness. So that by 1977, when I visited Iran and found from bankers that millions of tumans were being taken out of people's personal accounts and deposited abroad, by that date I began to realize, I found that in 1975, sorry. It was in 1975, I think, that I began really to apprehend danger. And in 1977, my next visit again to apprehend danger. It was in 1975 that Asadullah Alam told me he could no longer have a rational conversation with the ruler, and that the monomania had got so great. The British ambassador at the time said that to me. And the monomania is so appalling in the Shah. And I remember saying, oh, monomania is a term I don't like to use of anybody. I keep it specially for Hitler. And he said, well, whatever you do with the term monomania, I'm going to use it of the Shah, he said. This in 1975. So in 1975, I thought that that was obviously the thing was going to crack up, all the signs were there. Failures in the public services, the public utilities, electricity failures and so on. A general discontent and, of course, appalling corruption. Appalling stories of vast sums of money changing hands in commissions, it was called, commissions on contracts and that kind of thing.
But don't you think that also Iranians, it seems to me, they are very sensitive to corruption and charges of corruption at the same time as being utterly corrupt? For instance, corruption, which is called commission, is sort of institutionalized in the West. Everybody accepts this like 10% commission or something like that. It's perfectly all right. Some people, like art dealers and